From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, ahead of his talk in Milwaukee Tuesday, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning author David Marinus about his newest book, A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father.
Then the story of the Wisconsin company that revolutionized colon cancer screening.
The most energizing part was all along the way, so many naysayers saying, you can't do this. You'll never be able to accurately detect colon cancer from a stool test. On and on. And so that was kind of the energy that fueled, coupled with the knowledge that you could have a huge impact on human health.
And the unique Raphael Simon, who writes young adult books under the name Pseudonymous Bosch.
Some people might realize that Pseudonymous Bosch is a play on Hieronymus Bosch, the painter. I try not to talk about that with children because I don't necessarily want them looking close at the paintings and then, you know, getting hate mail from their parents.
Yeah. Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. David Marinus usually writes about other people. The Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist has penned deeply researched and best-selling books about former presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, baseball player Roberto Clemente, and legendary Packers coach Vince Lombardi.
Marinus's newest book is called A Good American Family, and it tells the story of his father, Elliot Marinus, who was brought before the House Un-American Activities Committee in Detroit in 1952. The elder Marinus was questioned for 2 weeks but refused to name names. He was then fired from his newspaper job and blacklisted for the next 5 years.
David Marinus will be the keynote speaker at Tuesday's literary luncheon at the Milwaukee Public Library. He joined us by phone earlier this week to explain how the Red Scare touched him and his family.
We were living in Detroit, Michigan. My mother was from Ann Arbor, my father from Brooklyn, but they met at the University of Michigan and then moved to Detroit, where my father was a newspaper man. And in 1952, the House Un-American Activities Committee came to Detroit to hold regional hearings on communism in the Detroit area. There was a star witness at those hearings who later became known as the grandmother spy, who had spent 9 years infiltrating the Communist Party in Michigan. She came in from the cold after those 9 years for these hearings and named hundreds of names. And my father was one of those, and he was sort of collateral damage in those hearings. They were really trying to go after the United Auto Workers labor union force in Detroit, which had a strong communist and socialist segment to it. My father had been writing for a communist newspaper in Detroit. He was not a spy. He was not a secret agent. He did not advocate the violent overthrow of the government. He was essentially persecuted for his ideology, for his beliefs. He would later say that he was stubborn in his ignorance about aspects of communism, but he had a strong sense of freedom of speech and freedom of the press and wanted to tell the committee what his vision of being an American was, which was quite different from theirs.
Yeah, I think a lot of people at the time, or looking back on it, realized that they probably had a misunderstanding of what was happening, particularly under Stalin's rule in the Soviet Union. Yeah, but that the idea of, you know, workers' rights was not something that they ever let go of, that was somehow separate from, as you say, from the ideology. And he was never allowed to actually read his statement, was he?
No, he had a very powerful statement on freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and he wrote it to deliver to the committee. The chairman of the committee, a Georgian who was a Southern racist who voted against every civil rights measure in Congress and for the poll tax and had briefly been a member of the Klan, said that my father could not read the statement unless he was contrite and sought absolution for his sins and named names, which my father refused to do. So the statement was essentially put into the files of the committee and buried there for 63 years until I went to the National Archives and came across it. And it was an incredibly emotional moment for me to see what my father had written.
Had he ever talked about what he had written?
No, he didn't really talk much at all about that whole experience, that whole part of his life. He had survived it after 5 years of blacklisting. When we got to Madison, Wisconsin, and he started his long and distinguished career at the Madison Capital Times, he didn't look back and he didn't talk about it. It was a shadow of our lives. It wasn't that we didn't know about it. It just was something in the past. And so he never talked about the statement. The only reason I knew it might exist is because there was a transcript of the hearing, a public transcript, which I had read, and it shows him saying, I'd like to read a statement about what I think it means to be an American, and the chairman would not allow him to do that. So I wasn't really expecting to find it, but there it was when I opened up a file on the hearings in Detroit, specifically a file that was titled Elliot Marinus, and in that file of my father's was the statement.
When you started this book, what did you want to understand about your father and his choices that you didn't understand?
Well, my policy for any book I undertake is that I know nothing. In this case, you know, in other books, you know, biographies of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and Vince Lombardi, they were strangers to me at the start and became very familiar to me after years of research. In this case, in one sense, my parents were intimately familiar to me at the beginning, and I was afraid that by the end they'd seem like strangers. That wasn't the case. I really came with a deeper appreciation of the struggles that they went through, of the thinking that led them in the ways that it did, how they recovered from that and recovered from the trauma of the blacklisting. And it also gave me a deeper understanding of myself, of my own sensibilities, why I am the way I am. My dad taught me to be open-minded, to not fall for any rigid ideology, to search for the truth wherever it took me, to hate racism but not the racist. You know, that was part of his mantra. And all of that were the lessons that he learned from his own experiences.
Why now? Why was it important to you to dig into your family's story now?
Well, there are obviously echoes of today, but I started this story before the era of Donald Trump. I would say that why now for me was because I was in my 60s. I was, you know, a lot of people in that period of their life start looking back and wondering about the forces that shaped them. I'd done it with strangers before, and I realized it was time for me to figure out my own family and myself, and that's why I did it. And then the echoes started ringing, as they almost always do. So, you know, the central themes of this book are relevant today, or maybe more relevant than ever, in terms of the manipulation of fear as a political weapon, the demonization of certain outsider groups, and that central question of what does it mean to be an American?
And do you have an answer to that for yourself?
Well, I have an answer that's different from the one that's being propagated today, absolutely. That there are a lot of different types of good American families, and my family certainly was one of those, and that this country is based on civil liberties, and that that's an essential part of this country's fabric, and those civil liberties have to be maintained above all else, and that America is nothing if it's not an open society.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking as I was reading the book that we are all a collection of contradictions. I mean, there isn't a person that has a straight line from one thing to the end of their life. You know, we all have a lot of things that make up who we are. And it's, you know, as we get older, I think it's reconciling all of that and trying to figure out, as you say, what it is that makes us who we are now.
That's a great point, Bonnie. And I think that's very true, that we, you know, all of us are a bundle of contradictions and competing forces, and there are certain through lines that go through our lives, and understanding those and how they shaped us and why we are what we are is what life is all about.
One of the things that struck me, and of course it would because of the profession that you and I are both in, is that your father didn't want to be called a journalist. He thought that was too highfalutin. He liked newspaper man.
He liked reporter and newspaper man. You know, he loved Orwell and H.L. Mencken in various ways, and he had a strong feelings about the use of language and trying to make it as clear and clean as possible and not use any euphemisms. And maybe he thought journalist was a little too much of that sort. But, you know, I can live with the title. But, he taught me, call yourself a reporter.
Yeah, because that's really what if you're doing your job right, that's what you're doing.
Exactly.
And you're presenting it to people so that they can make up their minds.
Right. You're not writing a journal.
Right. Yes, or a novel. I think sometimes it feels today like we're in some sort of dystopian science fiction thing.
That's for sure.
What do you think your father would have made of our times?
My dad was an eternal optimist. That's one of the things that got him through all of his own troubles. And his motto tended to be, it could be worse. I think that related probably to what he had endured himself. I think that, he died before Obama and before Trump. So I think he would have seen the promise and the despair of the American cycle of history.
Again, having finished the book, thinking, I would love to know what he would write about where we are now.
Yeah, I think that he would draw the comparisons with the past and see how we've learned from them and how we haven't, and probably strike an optimistic note about where we're going to end up.
Are you optimistic?
If we get through this. He inculcated that into me. I'd say that it's a stronger test of my optimism today than ever before in my life. My feeling is that the short term is iffy, the long term is better. So if we get through the short term, I'm fairly optimistic.
In a number of times, and you've referenced it in this conversation about how he was determined to look forward. He was not going to dwell in the past. He was not going to be bitter about what happened to him. If there was something that you could ask him right now that he would answer, and that you would hope he would answer, what would it be? Did you have questions that came up during the writing of this that you thought, I wish he was here, I could ask him about this?
Well, I would love to know what it was like during those few weeks, when he was in the crucible. I can only imagine. And I don't know that he would tell me, but I would love to ask him those questions. When you were writing your statement, what was that? What were the feelings that were going through you? Did you think you would survive it? Did you know you would? How traumatic was it for you? And how did you maintain your optimism through all of the next 5 years?
For me, I thought it must have been terrifying to sit in there knowing that the full force of your own government was against you.
Yeah, that's the thing. That there's different levels of power, and to face the power of government, its ability to disrupt and destroy lives is frightening, and he had to deal with that.
When you're talking to people about this, and you're going to be doing that here in Milwaukee for the library, what do you want people to take away from the book, other than knowing more about you and your family and this particular set of circumstances? Is there a greater theme that you want people to be thinking about?
Oh, there absolutely is, and that's the importance of civil liberties as the foundation of the American democracy. And I end my speech reading my father's statement because it went unread. And now, as his son, I'm able to read it to the world. And it's an incredibly powerful statement. And I think when people hear that, they'll go away hearing enough of what I have to say.
Would you mind reading some of it for us?
I will. I was taught as a child and in school that the highest responsibility of citizenship is to defend the principles of the U.S. Constitution and to do my part in securing for the American people the blessings of peace, economic well-being, and freedom. I have tried to do that to the very best of my ability. And for doing just that and nothing more, I have been summarily discharged from my job. I have been blacklisted in the newspaper business after 12 years in which my competence and objectivity have never once been questioned. I must sell my home, uproot my family, and upset the tranquility and security of my three small children in the happy formative years of their childhood. But I would rather have my children miss a meal or two now and have them grow up in the gruesome, fear-ridden future for America projected by members of the House Committee on Un-American Activity. I don't like to talk about these things, but my Americanism has been questioned, and to properly measure a man's Americanism, he must know the whole pattern of a life. The U.S. Constitution and its Bill of Rights are not simply musty documents in a library. They have meaning only if they are used. To betray and subvert the Bill of Rights is the most un-American act any man or committee can do. So that document was brought into being and maintained throughout our history by men who gave their blood and their lives in blood. That's what makes this committee so dangerous. Ostensibly designed to protect the government against overthrow by force and violence, it proceeds by force, terror, and threats to overthrow the rights of the American people. The committee reflects no credit on American institutions or ideas. Its attempt to enforce conformity of political or economic thought is a long step toward dictatorship that holds the greatest danger to the American people. In this country, we have never acquiesced to the proposition that people could be punished for their beliefs.
Well, David Marinus, we are so looking forward to having you in Milwaukee, back home in Wisconsin. And safe travels until then. And thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Bonnie. And I can't wait to get back to Madison and Milwaukee and Wisconsin.
Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus is an editor at The Washington Post and author of numerous best-selling books. His most recent is A Good American Family, The Red Scare, and My Father.
Marinus will be in Milwaukee on Tuesday to speak at the Milwaukee Public Library's Spring Literary Lunch. There is more information at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now, and then our regular segment on business and entrepreneurship tells the story of a Wisconsin healthcare company that's making a national impact on colon cancer screening. Lake Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It's time now for our monthly series on entrepreneurship and innovation called How Did You Do That?
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is the executive director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keane.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angel Investors, and this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
I thought that the way to market this would be to educate people about the disease and the statistics and the mortality and rates, and clearly that scared people. If you make colon cancer screening fun and accessible, people are willing to do it.
After successfully growing and steering the $582 million sale of Madison-based Third Wave Technologies, Kevin Conroy went looking for another company to run. He found Exact Sciences, a struggling publicly traded Massachusetts company with a DNA-based test for colon cancer that hadn't been approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
Kevin took over in April 2009. At that time, Exact had a handful of employees, was worth about $30 million, and was trading at around $1 a share. 10 years later, the company has more than 2,000 employees, about 300 job openings, and a stock price that reached into the high 90s with a total value of about $11.5 billion. That colon cancer test, now called Cologuard, got FDA approval and has been used to screen more than 2 million people.
On a mission to help detect cancer at its earliest stages, Exact is making progress on a non-invasive test for liver cancer and has others in the pipeline. Kevin, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thank you. I really appreciate the chance to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Kevin. You grew up in Flint, Michigan. How did that shape your views about communities?
Well, when I grew up in the 70s in Flint, Michigan, there were over 80,000 employees of General Motors in a county with about 450,000 people. So it was a classic one-employer town, and it was a really healthy community and great place to grow up with terrific public schools, which I went to. And over a period of about a decade and a half, you saw that employment decline from 80,000 to 6,000. And that left a pretty big impact on the community. And what I saw during that time left an imprint on what type of leader I wanted to be. I not only wanted to be a leader that made an impact in, you know, some area for me, healthcare, but also in a way that had a positive impact on the economy and the lives of the people who live in the community. So a huge impact. And what has occurred in Flint since then, it's heartbreaking. And hopefully it's a story that doesn't repeat itself very often in this country.
You had a lot of training to become a leader, Kevin. You went to University of Michigan Law School, practiced law in Chicago as an intellectual property lawyer, worked at a California startup, then got a job as an intellectual property lawyer at GE Healthcare. Then you became the top lawyer at Third Wave Technologies. That company had something like 100 research projects going on when you moved into the CEO job. How did you manage that?
Well, on day one, we sat down as a team, and the company was troubled. It was effectively running out of cash, and it wasn't getting products through the product development cycle and to the patients and physicians who needed these tests that we were trying to develop. And so we took a big list of projects down to two. One was an HPV test, a test for cervical cancer, a screening test. And the other was a test that was about, had already been submitted to the FDA for cystic fibrosis. So we said, let's just do three things this year. Let's make some real progress in product development. Let's grow our sales by 25%. And thirdly, let's raise the capital we need to be successful. And that's what we got the whole company focused on. And it was energizing, I think, for everybody.
And it worked. You ended up selling the company to Hologic?
Yes. So we took the company from about a $70 million market cap, and 2.5 years later, it was acquired for $580 million. More important than that reward to investors was the fact that we got this cervical cancer screening test approved by the FDA ahead of the two big companies that were doing this, even though they both started well before us. And it's a testament to focus and creating energy within an organization to be successful.
You know, Kevin, we skipped over something there. Kathleen said you were a partner at a law firm for 9 years, and then you did a startup in California. That doesn't seem to be a typical lawyer's risk profile. How many kids did you have at the time that you decided to resign from this firm where you were a partner?
Well, we had one with one on the way. My wife had just made partner at her firm. I had just made partner at my firm. I think I had been to one partner meeting and made this decision to leave, and we took about a 70% family pay cut, and the cost of our house doubled. I'm not quite sure what that risk gene is, but clearly there is one there, and it's a desire to kind of make a difference more than worrying about your paycheck day to day. In hindsight, it might have been a foolish thing to do, but I'm glad that we did it.
So back to you sold Third Wave Technologies to Hologic, and you made a lot of money, and you were young, so you had to figure out what to do next. How did you go through the process of figuring that out and finding a company to run?
After Third Wave was acquired, I spent about 6 months intently looking for different opportunities, came pretty close to buying a company based in the UK with Manish Arora, who had been the chief financial officer at Third Wave, and ultimately decided that Exact Sciences was the thing that was the most exciting. And it goes back to 10 years ago, a meeting at the Mayo Clinic with Dave Ahlquist that inspired me to go down a path which at the time looked really, really challenging. The Exact Sciences board reached out and said, would you like to talk to us? And I met with them. And after meeting with them, I said, there's nothing here. There's no product, there's no real intellectual property, and there are no employees other than one person. And they said, before you say no, go meet with Dave Ahlquist at the Mayo Clinic because he has some really interesting research, and indeed he did. He had data showing the ability to detect over 90% of colon cancers from a stool sample. That was the proof of concept. So when we joined, Manish and I joined Exact Sciences, it was with the plan to partner with Mayo Clinic.
Without a deep science background yourself, how do you approach running a company such as this with so much science intensivity in the business?
I've always been fascinated by science, and even though I was in electrical engineering in undergraduate, I took all of my courses in biology. And actually, biology is it's pretty straightforward. It's actually pretty easy to learn DNA. It's something that is logical and explainable. And so that hasn't been the biggest challenge, learning the science. If you work with really good people, they can explain these concepts pretty clearly.
Then what's the biggest challenge?
Building a team, raising capital, developing a plan that you can really deliver on, getting into guidelines, running a big clinical trial, developing a product under FDA intense scrutiny, and then ultimately changing the practice of medicine is really a challenge. It's just been a whole host of challenges, and maybe the most energizing part was all along the way so many naysayers saying, you can't do this. People won't do a stool-based test. You'll never be able to accurately detect colon cancer from a stool test, on and on and on. And so that was kind of the energy that fueled, coupled with the knowledge that you could have a huge impact on human health.
So, Kevin, kind of off the topic of exact sciences for a moment, what you just said sounds an awful lot like the same sort of path down which Theranos came for the last 10 or 15 years. And yet we know how awfully that's come out. And I think that one of the really interesting topics here is, you know, you've succeeded at all these things and proven all this stuff. Talk to us a bit about how an investor should have been thinking about Theranos, or what you see there that is so different than what you're talking about.
Well, here is the giveaway with Theranos, and I compare this to how we approached investors at Exact Sciences. Every time we ran a study, we blinded the data, we opened that database, the biostatisticians did, and then we presented that data at a scientific conference so the tires could be kicked. And then we published the data in a peer-reviewed journal. Theranos refused to do that. One of the very few companies in healthcare that refused to publish data. And that was a tell. Those of us in the industry knew what the problem they were trying to solve was a really hard problem, a tiny amount of blood using engineering called microfluidics. It's really hard. Many of us thought this was a scam. And she largely went to investors who weren't healthcare investors, who didn't know that you presented data. She was going to to tech investors where you'd never presented data. You kept everything secret. And that's how she was able to really scam not only investors, worse. She did that to people and gave them false test results. That's inexcusable.
Speaking of healthcare, Kevin, you said earlier that one of your goals is to change the practice of medicine. Could you talk about that a little more?
Those of us who are trying to innovate in medicine, we all know that one of the hardest things to do is to change the trained behaviors of physicians, healthcare providers, and large health systems. It takes time. It takes an incredible amount of data, peer-reviewed publications, and education. And that is a long process, and you have to be prepared for that as an innovator. For example, if you look at Cologuard, it is clearly superior in large studies to the alternative stool-based test, yet it takes a lot of time to educate physicians to that fact. You need to meet with them and talk to them and present them with the data, and that takes time, money, and a huge amount of effort.
Now, in terms of educating the public about Cologuard, you've got the TV commercials with the little box running around. Can you tell us how those commercials evolved?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny when Manish and the marketing leadership brought the first storyboard with the box to me. I said to them, have you all taken leave of your senses? And they said, hey, do you want to see the focus group results? And it was stark. I thought that the way to market this would be to educate people about the disease and the statistics and and the mortality and rates. And clearly that scared people. If you make colon cancer screening fun and accessible, people are willing to do it. And so it took about 3 minutes to convince me that I was wrong. And indeed, this has been, I look at it as a huge public health service to educate people about screening. And we've screened 2 million people over the last 4 years.
So, Kevin, another part of being a good entrepreneurial leader has to do with culture and how you build a company. If we went and asked employees about the culture at Exact, what would they say, do you think?
We do it's an old Gallup survey of 12 questions that gets to employee engagement. And last year, we were in the 83rd percentile of all life science companies. I think the way that we have built culture is to hire people who care first about the mission. It's, I think, easier to build culture in Wisconsin than in other parts of the country because people come to the company and are willing to work really hard for that mission. And they don't jump around from company to company. We have a very low attrition rate. So we started with just some basic principles like teamwork, integrity, quality, accountability, and really tried to, whenever in doubt, go back to those principles. If there's a question, do you do the right thing or do you come close to the line? No, just do the right thing. That's our principle of integrity. And we talk about that at every all-employee meeting. The other thing is constant communication. So we have three priorities every year. We talk about those priorities, and then I and management are in front of all employees 4 times a year at least, answering questions directly. You don't go hide in a corner. You actually have to engage with people, all of the people in the company, to make sure that, you know, people can look you right in the eye and ask you the hard questions that affect their lives. I don't know that there's magic to it, but I do think three priorities and frequent communication as to progress makes a big difference.
So, Kevin, all of this sounds easy, but we know it's been really difficult. What are the biggest obstacles you've faced in all of this, and how did you take care of those?
Well, probably the single biggest event that put the company at risk was when the main guideline group that is the most important preventive medicine guideline initially came out with an equivocal guidance on Cologuard because there was only one large study. And that was a real challenge. Our stock dropped from $30 a share to $6 a share. And maybe it bottomed out at $5 a share. And it was a real problem. And what happened was a second study was published with about a week to go before the deadline. And then they took a look at that study and the evidence, and they included Cologuard as an A-rated colon cancer screening test. And it's been no looking back since then. Since that point in time, we've probably screened 1.7, 1.8 million people.
And that guideline is important because that's what insurers look at to determine whether they'll cover the test.
Exactly.
So you're developing a new test for liver cancer, and you have some others in the pipeline. How does this fit into your vision for Exact?
Our goal at Exact is to be the early cancer detection company. We are really focused on detecting cancer early, from, in the case of liver cancer, a simple blood draw. Our research program with the Mayo Clinic, though, is identifying biomarkers in the top 15 cancer killers. And ultimately, the goal is to develop one blood draw. Do you have any of the top 15 cancers? And by the way, which organ should we go look at? Because today, we screen for organs, not people. We do not have cancer screening of people. We screen particular organs. We have breast cancer, cervical cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer. Why not screen a person? The incidence of the disease is really high if you aggregate those 15 cancers. It's the number one killer for people under 85. So there has to be a better way. That's ultimately the goal. And I just look at the last 10 years have been really exciting. The next 10 years are going to be more exciting.
Love your big goals, Kevin. We'll look forward to watching your progress on them. And thanks for visiting with us today.
Thanks, Kathleen. Thanks, Tim.
You can read more about this story and find links to resources by visiting wuwm.com.
And listen to all our podcasts at WUWM at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll take one more break, and then the unique young adult writer Raphael Simon, who goes by the name Pseudonymous Bosch. Lake Effect returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are some writers out there who not only draw readers in with creative plots, but with creative use of words. For adults, that might include Jasper Ford's Thursday Next series or Terry Pratchett's Discworld books. And generations of kids have grown to love wordplay thanks to books like Norton Juster's 1961 classic, The Phantom Tollbooth.
More recently, middle grade and young adult readers have been delighted by the books of a writer whose name itself evokes a love of wordplay, the delightfully named Pseudonymous Bosch, whose latest book, The Unbelievable Oliver, is for younger readers and who may or may not be related to the Raphael Simon whom I met at Boswell Book Company recently. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk.
It's a pleasure. I've been dug out of my cave to go on a book tour, having to see hundreds of children at a time. So this is a break and much more like my daily life, just to talk to one person in one place.
Well, very nice of you to say. You've been writing books as Pseudonymous Bosch for more than 10 years at this point, right?
The first book was in 2007. That was the name of this book, A Secret. And I guess that's 12 years. My math is not strong, but I think that's about right. I started it a little earlier. It was a book that took a long time because I started writing it spontaneously for a fourth grade girl in installments through the mail. And then it took a long time to actually turn it into a book and then for me to become a book author after that.
What happened to cause you to start writing this book in installments for a fourth grade girl through the mail?
Well, I was literally forced to volunteer at this girl's school by her mother, who was a good friend of mine. Volunteering not usually being in my nature. And at the time, I was a kind of struggling screenwriter / journalist / whatever. And I was going to send her some writing through the mail. That was the idea, but I didn't have anything to send because we were called Writing Partners. That was the name of the program. So I started to write a novel and I couldn't even think of a title initially. I was so blocked. And then I thought, wait, I know why I don't know the name of the book. It's because the name of this book is Secret. It kind of went on from there. My secret identity, Pseudonymous Bosch, sort of sprung out of that as well.
Well, I was going to ask whether there was a moment that you remember that name coming to you.
This girl, May was her name, wasn't supposed to know who I was. And she might have recognized the name Raphael Simon, which I haven't used since. So I had to come up with something else. And, some people might realize that Pseudonymous Bosch is a play on Hieronymus Bosch, the painter. I try not to talk about that with children because, especially the young ones, I don't necessarily want them looking close at the paintings and then, getting hate mail from their parents.
Well, and it is a little fun to think of the challenges that your young readers probably have in going to the library desk and asking for and trying to pronounce Pseudonymous for starters.
Well, sure, and with the name of this book, A Secret, that was a lot of who's on first, I think, with some of the librarians trying to find the book.
Well, and the kicker to this, right, is that the fourth grader became your agent, is that right?
No, no, but actually my agent, funnily, is somebody I went to school with, so it's close.
Well, and so I guess the question is, because you've been this kind of struggling writer over the years leading up to that point, do you feel like writing books as Pseudonymous Bosch, writing this first book, kind of creating an alter ego helped you find your voice in some way?
Oh, absolutely. It allowed me to kind of think of myself as a character, and it was much more freeing and less self-conscious than it might have been for me to be embarking on writing a novel as Raphael Simon. I felt I could be silly. I could even be more serious than I might be without feeling or be pretentious, and I wasn't self-conscious about it. And it turned out to be the right thing for me at the time.
And the things like the puns and the wordplay, you kind of flow naturally out of Pseudonymous in a way that they would feel self-conscious if they were coming out of Raphael?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think anybody, you know, when you get on stage, you're a different person than you are off stage, and it's sort of the same kind of thing.
Do you feel like is the book your stage? Is the printed word your stage in some way?
Yes, I can use that as a very smooth transition to The Unbelievable Oliver. If we
well, absolutely. Talk because The Unbelievable Oliver obviously is obviously if you've read it skews a little bit younger, but there's clearly there's a pseudonymous Boshness to it as well.
Right, I tried to be a little simpler. In the earlier Secret Series books, there's a lot of authorial interjection, footnotes. You know, breaking of the fourth wall. There's a little bit of that in a kind of more simplified way in Oliver. And because the intention here was to write a book that was a little bit easier to read, and a little shorter, had more pictures. It sort of comes out of how the origin of the book, which is sort of twofold. There's a kind of twofold story to that. The first is that as a pseudonymous anonymous author like myself, you are subjected to many rumors. My readers like spread all kinds of stories about me. And one of these rumors, which was a little bit malicious, a little pernicious, was that I did not write my own books. Many of my readers have speculated that not I, but my rabbit, Quiche, writes my books. And I always tell them, no, that's not true. The rabbit is merely my typist, my secretary, and all the ideas are my own. But that got me thinking about the idea of a magician with a rabbit who was the secret brains behind his magic act. And, you know, since I wanted to be a magician when I was a kid and since I write for kids, it was natural that I'd become a kid magician. So that's how the seed of the story came to be. Because the unbelievable Oliver is a boy magician with a rabbit who is on the lam from Las Vegas. He gets found by Oliver, and Oliver, who's sort of a hapless kid, he and the rabbit, they strike a deal where the rabbit will help him through his act in exchange for, as he says, half the money, or 60-40, right down the middle, as the rabbit says. Anyway, at the same time that this idea was coming to me, I was also dealing with something in my so-called real life, which is in which I have twin daughters who are then around 7 or 8. And I don't know if other writers experience this, but I had a lot of trouble getting my daughters to read. They loved graphic novels and comics and read them compulsively. And I love comics and graphic novels myself. However, well, they didn't have to read my books necessarily, but somebody's. I wanted them, you know, with chapter books, they called the books without pictures, but I just couldn't get them interested. But there was one book called Ivy and Bean that they quite liked. It was shorter than the books that I was giving them and had more pictures. And I thought, okay, well, why don't I try that? So that's how Oliver sort of took that form. And then I had a real stroke of inspiration. I decided to put the girls in the book. So Oliver's friends are these twins who have two dads, just like my twins do. And that really did the trick. Suddenly my daughters were interested in the book and I could get them to read it. So I heartily recommend that to all authors who want their children to be interested in their books. Just put them in the books and you might have a better result.
Well, right. It's funny, you know. People talk about a reader's ability to see themselves in the characters. In this case, they literally are seeing themselves in these characters.
Exactly, and you know, in fact, they're frustrated that they don't resemble them more perfectly.
Was it a challenge to kind of change that narrative voice a little bit? I will admit at this point that most of the exposure I've had to the Secret series has come from my 11-year-old reading passages from it out loud to me, which he is a fan of doing whatever he's reading, sometimes from the bath. And I'm sure he's glad to hear me saying this right now. But, you know, this is obviously, you were saying, some of the wordplay had to be toned down a little bit. Do you still feel like you're able to be pseudonymous Bosch, even though you're, I guess, writing for your daughters?
You know, it was a little bit of a balancing act, I'll admit. But you know, with a few exceptions, I'm not thinking of any offhand, but I know there were a few words that we ultimately took out because maybe they were too polysyllabic or what have you. But, you know, it's a truism in the children's lit world that you're not supposed to talk down to your audience. And that goes for when you're writing books for 3 and 4-year-olds as well as 7-year-olds or 8-year-olds or 9-year-olds. So I try not to do that and to think of my books, and that started with The Secret Series because of the way that first book was written, as kind of a conversation with my readers. And that's been true over the years as my readership has grown and I've gotten lots of emails from kids. There's a real back and forth in my mind, and the books are almost collaborations, sometimes almost literally. I might say borrow or be inspired by some ideas that some kids have given me. And then with this, obviously, I was thinking about my daughters and you know, some younger kids more generally. And what I find, I guess I'm saying, is that if you think really about who you're speaking to, it almost happens naturally.
Well, and you mentioned that the characters, these are Bee and Teenie, in the book have two dads, just like your daughters do in real life. They're also gay grandfathers in your other books, I think. You wrote in the New York Times a few years ago about the realization that in writing about secrets in your books, you might have been writing all along about being gay. Since that essay, have you gained any more clarity about where that part of you figures in your writing?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, that was coming from a place of kind of introspection where I was feeling a little bit uncomfortable about writing under a pseudonym and feeling like that was putting me back in the closet, even though personally I'd come out of the closet, you know, as a freshman in college many years ago. But then I kind of looked back at my books and thought, gosh, you know, I thought I wasn't putting much of my gay experience into this, but so much of what being a young gay person or a kid is often in this country and around the world about having a secret. And here I wrote this entire series about having a secret. So it felt true to me. And, you know, I'm still thinking about what a kind of post coming out as Raphael Simon writing career might be. So I'm not sure exactly what's next.
But at the same time, it has to be kind of fascinating as a writer to have enough material out there that you can go back and kind of learn something about yourself from considering the, you know, the bulk of what you've written.
Yeah, I mean, on a slightly lighter note, I had a kid ask me today, and this is, I've seen so many kids over the years and been asked so many questions, and I don't think anyone's ever asked me this before. He said, do you ever look at your old books and see something that you would like to change? And of course, the answer to that is yes, all the time. You know, I know a lot of readers won't even read their own books for that reason, and the actors won't watch their own movies. I don't have that much self-control. I do occasionally look at my own and see. So, you know, and it's interesting with the grandfathers in particular. You mentioned the gay grandfathers. You know, it was important. My first book was in 2007. It was a slightly different world out there. It was important for me to have some gay characters. But frankly, I was a little bit timid, I think, about the way I portrayed it. And I don't think I wasn't explicit that they were a couple or that they were gay. And I think unless you were from a world, probably mostly a coastal world, I'm going to say, you know, LA, New York, San Francisco, where at that time it was much more common to have gay couples and gay families around, I don't think you would have picked up on it. I think I would write that differently now.
Well, and in the new book, I mean, the characters aren't even really in the book so much as they are referenced in the book. But again, you're dealing with kind of a younger audience. But what you've done seems like it feels very normal.
Yeah, and it's true that we were joking about my daughters wanting to be seen in the book, but all kids want to be represented, and just the way that you would want to represent kids from different ethnic backgrounds, different racial backgrounds, different, you know, religions, whatever, there are also kids who grow up in gay families, and you want to represent them in that same sort of cultural way, in a sense. It's not about, you know, the fathers themselves aren't necessarily important characters. It's just important to know that this is how these girls grew up, and that's their experience, the same way that Oliver is obviously Jewish and has to go to Hebrew school.
Right, and I was actually just going to point that out. He makes a reference early on in the book to going to Hebrew school, but I think there's really not much more beyond that makes the case that he's Jewish. But someone who's Jewish and reads that book, you know, automatically feels like, oh, this is somebody I recognize.
Right, and we tried, and then, you know, and even less explicitly, but there are other characters of color in the book who are drawn that way, even if they're not written that way. And It's hard to really, you know, represent everybody, and certainly in every book, and you don't necessarily want to, because then you can misrepresent people. But over time, I've realized just how important it is for kids to see characters like themselves or a world that they can imagine themselves in. Otherwise, it can be an alienating experience. They're not going to love reading. They're not going to get that. So much of reading for kids is about learning who they are. And I, you know, one of the things I think about writing for kids is that it's about self-discovery, where often writing for adults is more about a vacation for the, you know, it's discovering something else, discovering something outside themselves, discovering the world. But kids are, in a sense, are still discovering themselves.
What an interesting point. Well, Raphael Pseudonymous Simon Bosch, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. Best of luck to you, and hope we'll get a chance to talk again down the road.
Thank you. It's been a joy for me as well.
Raphael Simon, who writes under the name Pseudonymous Bosch, is the author of several books for young readers, including the name of this book, His Secret.
His latest book is for a slightly younger demographic. It's called The Unbelievable Oliver, and he was in Milwaukee recently. To talk about it, we met up with him at Boswell Book Company. That is all for the Tuesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. Please join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because fresh air is next.